This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Keep your eyes closed. Do you trust me?
I trust you.
All right. Open your eyes.
I'm flying! Jack!
You really know how to woo a girl, Michael.
I am king of the world, Josh.
And that right there may be the last reference to Titanic on this show, devoted to our top five movie boats. Maybe the last reference. We're not going to make any promises
Maybe not. This week's top five is inspired by the first famous boat, Noah's Ark, which returns to movie screens this weekend in Darren Aronofsky's Noah with Russell Crowe. Our review and more.
We're going to need a bigger show. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. Film Spotting listeners we know are involved in all three of those types of things, and we did hear from a listener and a supporter of the show, David L. Williams, who submitted this note about his use of Squarespace on the Film Spotting Facebook page. My Squarespace-built site has been a great way for me to create an online portfolio of my work. I can update my website with information and links about new productions, and the site easily allows people to read samples of my work and get in touch with me about my writing. PlaywrightDavid.com is David's site, and we will link to that in the show notes. For a free trial and 10% off your Squarespace account, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson. Michael Phillips is in for Adam Kempinar again this week. Hope you've got your sea legs for this week's show. We'll be counting down our top five movie boats a bit later.
But first, for his take on the Bible story, director Darren Aronofsky cast Gladiator's Russell Crowe as Noah. Were we not entertained? Josh and I weigh in.
Man corrupted his world and filled it with violence. So we must be destroyed.
A great flood is coming. We build a vessel to hold the innocent.
Mother! What is... them?
There isn't anything for you here.
You stand alone and defy me.
I'm not alone.
Michael, there was really only one thing that had me excited about Noah, the new big-budget Hollywood take on the Bible story. It wasn't curiosity about how this fantastic tale of every animal on Earth being shepherded into an ark to weather a worldwide flood would look in this age of advanced special effects and CGI. It wasn't the cast, which has the seemingly inevitable choice of Russell Crowe as Noah. It wasn't even the fact that this is a story I've known since childhood and still hold dear as a key text in the Christian faith. The main thing that interested me, to be honest, was the director, Darren Aronofsky. How did this guy end up making Noah? It isn't only the subject matter, the fact that Aronofsky, an atheist, would be interested in a Judeo-Christian story, but the pure size of the picture. Aronofsky made his name with a grainy black-and-white debut, Pi, and has largely worked on a smaller scale since. Requiem for a Dream, The Wrestler, Black Swan. These are personal and intimate, if also strikingly imaginative, films. Obviously, The Fountain is the outlier. That's his 2006 Mindbender, in which Hugh Jackman plays three different men in three different historical eras, all of whom are seeking the Fountain of Youth. It certainly had a bigger budget for Aronofsky and was concerned with key religious questions, so Noah may not seem as big of a leap compared to it. Yet I think The Fountain also reveals why Noah doesn't ultimately work, at least for me. The Fountain was distinctly an Aronofsky film, one that seemed to burst from his subconscious self and was then translated onto the screen by a team of artists tuned into his subliminal sort of wackiness. To my mind, Noah rarely works in this thrilling way. I'll get to my specific concerns, but for now, Michael, I'm curious what you thought of Noah as an Aronofsky project. Was there enough Aronofsky in it for you, or was this too anonymous, like one of the Hollywood Bible epics of old?
Well, that's well put, Josh. I think there's not enough Aronofsky in it for me, and I would say that there are two movies going on here. The one you visually identify almost instantly as Aronofsky, in that you have a lot of nervous, tight, handheld close-ups, lending a kind of practiced realism, let's say, maybe a heightened realism to this tale that doesn't necessarily seem like it would benefit from a documentary approach. But and the other movie in there, kind of at war with the Aronofsky film, is, as you say, more of a conventional, certainly digital effects driven spectacle that is perhaps aimed more at the broader audience, not necessarily the Christians going in who have a close relationship with this story. I don't. I'm an agnostic. I'm a Bible idiot. I'm a Bible know-nothing.
A Bible idiot.
I'm a Bible. Bible comes up on Jeopardy. I don't get it.
So did you learn a lot here then from Noah?
I learned a lot. I learned a lot. But before we get into the details, I actually did. I think I liked the movie more than you did, Josh. Hmm. In that, I did find it as kind of stubbornly, you know, these two halves will not play together very well. I did find the movie genuinely unpredictable, just in where the hell he's taking this three-page story from the book of Genesis. See, I know that much, right?
See?
but you certainly don't expect things like giant rock men.
Rock people, yes.
That are fallen angels reconfigured as stone formations that look like kind of Flintstones era Transformers.
Yes,
right?
They have that appeal, yes.
And the main one is voiced by, in fact, Nick Nolte. Okay, right there, Nick Nolte doing the voice of a rock monster in a movie about Noah's Ark. You know, I would have lost that bet going in. So there's enough of that kind of errant craziness in it that it's disappointing, but I didn't find it like, ugh, what a sellout. You know, he's completely lost his personality. There's enough strangeness going on here for me, but tell me about
your
concern.
I wouldn't characterize it as a sellout by any means. I mean, my sense is that he's working against a lot of forces here, studio forces, outside influences of what are you going to do with this story. And you can sense that tension, I think, in the finished product, not to its credit. There's certainly wrestling here with big theological questions, and I liked that, but it's not done in a way that I would identify as an Aronofsky film. And I don't think that this was impossible. The filmmaker that did come to mind as I was watching Noah, as big as it was, as crazy as it was, and I didn't remember the rock creatures either from my childhood story, so it really does go in some interesting directions. I thought of Christopher Nolan and how he has, since moving from really quirky small-budget films, been able to become a huge, big-time, big-budget filmmaker. Yet those things, like Inception, they move like clockwork. I mean, they have a personal vision at the heart of them, but they also move so fluidly despite their size and their moving parts and their effects. And this just did not happen for me at all with Noah.
Okay, I'd say this, complimenting that point, I think Nolan is a craftsman who's got a very sleek, kind of classical, old school touch, because he, among other things, he believes in shooting on film as often as he can. His images have a kind of a pristine, glacial elegance to them, even though the movies themselves don't feel glacial. It's kind of the opposite with Aronofsky, in that he's got moment to moment, he's got a lot of really kind of nervous urgency to the interpersonal relationships here. And this is basically a family trying to work out the world's largest problems in close quarters on an ark with a whole bunch of animals. And it's not as ridiculous as it sounds, because I think, you know, he's working with actors that know how to anchor a Bible epic of any sort. Russell Crowe, it may be inevitable, even cliche casting, but you know what? The guy's a good actor, and you believe him in period settings. So
that's
right,
true.
Right there, you're kind of, all right, you're not working, you know, you're already not working against your own movie when you have Russell Crowe in that kind of role. But Aronofsky's got kind of an odd way of letting the energy seep out of a dialogue-driven scene. And there's scenes that are dialogue-driven, and there's a lot of scenes that aren't in Noah. But the films kind of have that methodical, you know, ping-ponging back and forth between two actors just trying to bring some urgency to the tensions here. But it, I don't know if Aronofsky really pays enough attention to the momentum of a scene. And that the movie does feel kind of what it feels. Basically, its own length, which is 2 hours and 20 minutes. It doesn't feel shorter or longer. It just sort of feels what it is. But I guess the reason I find the film at least half interesting, Josh, is that Aronofsky is genuinely interested in these people as human beings caught up in cosmically important and mythical circumstances, let's say. And it's not just a bunch of pop-up figures from Sunday school. It's, you know, it has, for better or for worse, it's got kind of a rough-hewn texture. It's more medieval than anything, really, that kind of gives it a little grit and, you know, kind of kept me going even when I wasn't really buying half of what was going on. You know, now why didn't I buy it? I'm still puzzling that through, frankly, because it might just be my kind of general, you know, skepticism about religious matters. Who knows? But so I was kind of an interesting test audience for this, I think, in that I am going in the clean slate, you know, not I'm skeptical a little bit maybe, but really no preconceptions about what this movie, any movie based on Noah, this story in the Book of Genesis should or shouldn't have. You know, you listen to somebody like Glenn Beck, who's already been cranking
Let's
off
not.
On it. Yeah, I know. But he's been cranking off on the movie, and then he finally admits, well, I haven't seen it. Paramount shows it to him, and then he says, well, it's not the Noah I remember. You know, he's not a gentle, kind of supportive soul. Russell Crowe is playing a very, you know, kind of like near homicidal guy.
Yeah,
you know?
It's an interesting characterization. I mean, he's really a doomed prophet here, which was a different take for me, not one that I had a problem with. I think it brought up some really fascinating elements of the original Noah story. It also roots it in the personal, as you mentioned, so that these are humans. And I think that was the right decision to do that, to make this somewhat an intimate story, even though it's apocalyptic as well. Mm-hmm. Yet those dialogue-driven scenes that you mentioned were the real weak link for me here, because all of the things that this movie was digging into that sort of got me going in terms of what I was theologically interested in, you know, what makes someone good or evil? Should humanity be wiped out because they've reached this point of pure evil? Is there any good left in Noah and his family, or are they part of this evil crowd? They just need to move the animals to safety and die off themselves so that mankind was done with. That's all interesting stuff. It's all talked about at length in many shouting scenes between Noah and his sons early on, Noah and his wife, played by Jennifer Connelly. We have Emma Watson here as a girl the family adopts when she's young, grows up to be Emma Watson, and there's a very arresting dynamic when she becomes pregnant, somewhat thwarting Noah's plan. But again, that comes out in a dialogue scene, in a speech scene between them. This very odd last third of the movie pretty much hinges on one speech scene between Watson and Crowe. And it didn't work for me to hinge this fantastical tale on that, where we're being told what matters and characters are thinking it through out loud to each other.
When I heard talk of miracles, I dismissed them. But then I saw the birds with my own eyes, and I had to come. There isn't anything for you here. No. This all belongs to me. This land, this forest, that stronghold of yours. Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
Then what is it?
An ark. To hold the innocent when the Creator sends his deluge to wipe out the wicked from this world.
Return to your cities of Cain! No, we have all been judged!
I'm going to give you an Aronofsky touch that, to me, pointed what the movie could have been a really good Aronofsky film and still dealt with all these things. early on before the flood, Noah goes into the village that's been built up around the ark by this desperate warring tribe. And he sees that women are being traded for meat at one point. And there's a quick shot, a really surreal, disturbing shot of a guy who's gnawing on a raw leg, an animal leg in a corner. And the guy looks up and it's Noah. So Noah sees himself, and not only is this something right out of Black Swan, which is a movie I didn't care for all that much, but had tons more personality than this. I mean, I needed a lot more Black Swan in Noah, okay. I think. Okay. But that shows you how it's jarring. It throws you off. You're not quite sure where it comes from. Yet at the same time, it's getting at everything that's interesting about this movie in terms of good and evil and what we see in the hearts of men right there visually, cinematically, rather than all these speeches that we otherwise mostly get.
Yeah, that's well put. I get enough of that to kind of get me through this erratic half and half affair, Josh. I think what you're talking about, I got from certain shots where Noah's getting these sort of dreamlike premonitions of the flood to come.
The visions are probably a strong point. I'll give you that.
Yeah, and we see, and they're not, they don't sit on the movie in a ridiculous way. I mean, there's three or four kind of key ones that are pretty fleeting and very artfully realized, I think, mostly digitally, but there's some imagination in there, in that you see Noah, you know, just kind of floating underwater, surrounded by all kinds of, you know, floating bodies, animals, and this is kind of the message from the creator about what's to come and what has to be done quickly, and so get the gopher wood ready, you know, but it's I get just enough of that where I am reminded that it's made by a director who's a real filmmaker. And even if I have problems with the filmmaker in many instances, and here too, you get the technique. And I guess for me, Josh, the thing I was hanging on to that I did get, that's kind of more like old school Bible epic rooting interest in a way, is the struggle for the soul of one of the three sons. This is the one played by Logan Lerman, who falls in with the descendant of Cain, played by Rainn Winstone, who's basically Noah's adversary, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, all that is evil and dark and bloodthirsty in humankind versus Noah's, you know, model for a better future. And this struggle, it's kind of the platoon aspect of this movie, right? I mean, we have a guy with two potential father figures, and that's a very potentially cliched setup. But I found that you can take it seriously enough as human beings caught in the situation that it didn't feel like a Bible epic to me. It just felt like a story that happened to have this larger dimension with a glint anyway of the kind of crazed visionary filmmaker behind it. You know, like I say, half and half. This was a very hard thing to write about quickly because they showed this very
late. Yeah, it was a last minute thing.
Last minute screening, and I think Paramount is probably justifiably nervous about, you know, frankly, the caught between, you know, pleasing a kind of a traditional audience for this sort of film on the one hand, and then seeing if they can appeal to the folks who are actually going in interested fans of Aronofsky, and are they getting enough Aronofsky? You? No. Me? Half and half.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson alongside Michael Phillips, and we are talking about Noah, the new take on the Bible story from Darren Aronofsky, which opens in wide release this weekend. And yeah, I think Paramount probably does have a challenge on its hands in terms of marketing this and what they want to see finally on the screen. But I still say, if you're hiring someone like Aronofsky, you know, let them rip is kind of my thing on it. I think we've seen this happen with comic book properties. We're back to Nolan a little bit, but you could also go all the way back to Tim Burton. When you get a very unique creative sensibility and you're going to give them a big property, mm-hmm. I guess we could consider Noah a big property, let them go then, you know, don't. And I don't know any behind the scenes maneuvering besides that there was a lot of consultation with religious experts about the film. But really, if you're going to hire a guy like this, you should let him have his whack at it. I do want to ask you, though, because you haven't lived with this story, as you said, since you were a kid. So what did you make of how they handled the animals? I mean, everyone knows that the key thing about this story for so many people is getting every animal on Earth into the ark. How are you going to pull this off? And they do it with a combination. Well, it's mostly CGI, I think. Was this something that worked for you in terms of the story?
Well, I did love how they conspicuously avoid certain archetypal passengers we tend to get with just when we think about the story, which is like no giraffes, right? No giraffes. I mean, right there. And I think Aronofsky said in one interview that the one thing he wanted to avoid is the kind of shot from beneath epic pose of Russell Crowe's Noah with a pair of big giraffes behind him. Mm. You know, he didn't want that. And so you have a lot of low liars. You have a lot of snakes, frogs, tremendous number of birds. And then they're all, of course, they spend the movie under sort of a incense sedation. So they're,
that was a little odd to me. It's like they're kind of forgotten for the 3-hour cruise. It's like, well, the animals are asleep. We've got that covered.
Right. I know. And to me, that is the kind of nervousness maybe. And maybe it was just artful kind of redirection of the story. But I think it's a little frustrating for almost anybody in that you don't get the moment at the end where you actually see the animals hit the ground running on the new world before you can start despoiling that.
It's not exactly Jurassic Park in that sense. I'd agree. It was interesting that they seemed to fall back, and not that this was, again, the biggest deal to me except for a curiosity for how they would handle it. They did seem to fall back on the same shot. There are pretty much three sequences that I remember of animals entering the ark. You get this flock of birds that come flying through, which is pretty impressive, and you see it from inside the ark. The camera kind of pulls back as they enter in. They go back to that, though, when the snakes and the lizards come in. And then I think they return a third time when we get some larger beasts. And at that point, it was kind of like, okay, here we go again. We're getting some more animals. What I liked better, actually, is a little throwaway joke almost that comes a little bit earlier. It's a forest scene involving some of the people from the village, I believe, and one of Noah's sons. They're out there kind of spying around. And all of a sudden, some bears come rampaging through the villagers' camp out of nowhere, and no one knows what's going on. I mean, I liked how they handled that bit of it.
Yeah. There are a couple of moments of intentional comedy where I think Jennifer Connelly, as Noah's wife, she says, we have to bring the snakes too, you know, which, and there are moments, I have to say, that there's enough Aronofsky in this film, Josh, that there are moments where it really risks and probably goes over the line of unintentional laughs because it's kind of got that gleam occasionally of the visionary in its eye. And, you know, I think any movie that has the nerve to really go in that final third into this brooding, isolated, potentially very unsympathetic direction with Noah, just as he gets more and more kind of self-loathing and questioning his own, whether, you know, was I even right to listen to the creator above for what I've done, when he starts threatening his own kin at knife point. I mean, it's not the Bible movie a lot of people were expecting. And again, I at least found, you know, this is the credit I'll give it. It is unpredictable. It's also wholly erratic, but it's a film I'm looking forward to seeing again sometime, not necessarily tomorrow. I need at least 7 days.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. Noah is currently in wide release. If you see it, we want to hear what you think. Email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. We're also on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Life jackets required when we play Massacre Theater coming up. Then let us tell you about our boats. Well, at least our picks for the best movie boats of all time. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
The truth don't stop.
Brief reminder here, folks, that Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM.
Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content looks great on every device, every time. Easily embed videos and trailers via the simple YouTube and Vimeo integration. It's incredibly easy to use, but if you want some help, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year.
You don't need a credit card, however, to start a trial. You can just begin building your website. And then when you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
The devil's done.
Yo, Mook! Mookie!
What?
How come you got no brothers up on the wall?
Man, ask Sal, right?
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers up on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want. See? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Take it easy, pal.
And you, hey, don't stop me.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. That was Danny Aiello's Sal and Giancarlo Esposito's Buggin' Out in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. That movie celebrates its 25th anniversary this year, which will be commemorated at this year's Ebert Fest with Spike Lee in attendance. Michael, that is one of the main reasons, aside from the fact that you'll be attending, which we'll get to in a minute, but Spike Lee's attendance there is one of the main reasons I regret I'm probably not going to be able to make it this year. Since 1999, Ebert Fest has celebrated Roger Ebert's favorite and sometimes overlooked films and offered a rare chance to see them with their creators and occasionally with their actors. Ebert died just prior to last year's festival, but the festival's mission continues under the direction of Chaz Ebert and festival director Nate Cohn. The dates for this year's fest are going to be April 23 to 27, and it takes place at one of the great movie houses in the country, the 1,500-seat Virginia Theater in Ebert's hometown of Champaign, Illinois. Here's what is planned in addition to Do the Right Thing. Steve James will be there with his Ebert doc, Life Itself. Also, Jem Cohen with the 2013 film Museum Hours, one I saw late in the year last year and almost squeaked onto my top 10. Actress Brie Larson will be there with Short Term 12, which was a Film Spotting 2013 Golden Brick nominee. And a few other people, comedian actor Patton Oswalt will be there with Jason Reitman's Young Adult and Oliver Stone with his 1989 film Born on the 4th of July. Michael, you're going to be part of it this year. What are you going to be doing at the festival?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to be part of it most every year the last few years. And I'm going to do a Q&A with Ramin Barani, who's Goodbye Solo, not his most recent, but one of his best. Ebert was a huge fan of it.
Yeah.
I'll be doing the Q&A with him after the screening there. And this, for people who have not been to a screening of anything at the Virginia Theater down in Champaign, it's one of the great, as you say, one of the great old movie houses, certainly in the state. And if you haven't seen a movie just on a screen of a certain size lately, to see a film, maybe you know, maybe you don't know. And for a lot of people, it's going to be great to see Do the Right Thing kind of explode on the big screen again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is a great, you know, that's just Spike Lee's finest couple hours, for one thing. But it's something you just forget if you haven't seen a movie in a theatrical exhibition setting in a while. And that's what it's all about down there.
Or if you've never seen a movie from a balcony. They have a great balcony, actually. I mean, how many of those are left around
Josh,
the country?
I think you can make out in that balcony. I think you can. That's how big it is.
It's probably been done. Well, to see the full lineup, you can visit ebertfest.com or look for the link in the show notes. All right, from that list of intriguing films to a couple of questionable performances, it's time now for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Josh and I massacred this scene.
Welcome to the Hotel Earl. May I help you, sir?
I'm checking in, Barton Fink.
F-I-N-K? Fink. Barton, that must be you, huh?
Must be.
Okay, then, everything seems to be in order. Everything seems to be in order. Just... Are you a trans or a res?
Excuse me?
Transient or resident?
I don't know. I mean, I'll be here indefinitely.
That was John Turturro as Barton Fink and Steve Buscemi as Chet in Barton Fink from 1991, written and directed, of course, by Joel and Ethan Coen. Chet is the concierge of the Hotel Earl in that film. So the tie-in, pretty obvious one. We reviewed Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel on that same show. So we didn't think too hard for a tie-in that time, Michael. We took the easy way out. We heard from listener Jefferson Hyde in Seattle, who did put a lot more thought into our choice.
He wrote, "A hotel provides a place to stay and presents you with a place where you can set down some roots, get some stuff done, and really feel right at home. Except, of course, it's not home, it's a hotel. This feeling it provides is at best temporary and at worst a complete illusion. The hotel is a fake home, the same way that Grand Budapest's M. Gustave provides mature ladies with a boyfriend experience but is a fake boyfriend, the way Zubrovka is a fake country in the film, the way that films themselves, when they're not named Leviathan, are showing us a world we can comprehend in a very real way but ultimately are not real at all. There are few movies more self-aware of their filmitude than Barton Fink. Therefore, when Chet asks Barton, trans or res, he's actually asking, do you really exist? And when Barton responds that he's staying indefinitely, he's saying, not in the least. Embrace existentialism, my friends."
Wow. Thank you, Jefferson, for that glimpse into the life of your mind. If you want to hear that Massacre Theater performance, plus our top five Wes Anderson scenes and our review of Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel, it's episode number 481. You can find it on iTunes or at filmspotting.net. All right, Michael, when you have an obvious Massacre Theater like that, you get a lot of entries. That's one good aspect of it. So we have a lot of names to choose from here. Pick into the hat and select our winner.
Okay, Russell, fake reaching into the hat. Hey, Daniel Lipinski, Chicago. Congratulations. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your Film Spotting t-shirt.
Not so controlled. Seduces. Not just the prince, but the court, the audience, the entire world. Come on. The fuerte like a spider spinning a web. Attack it. Attack it. Come on.
Okay, Michael, the Massacre Theater scene for this show, I don't think it's quite as obvious as Barton Fink, though it is a well-known film. We're not getting too obscure here. The connection to our topic this week, top five movie boats and Noah, that's kind of dead on. So
it's a little bit, we're asking people to kind of dumb down as they guess, right?
Okay.
To guess stupidly.
There you go.
Okay.
There's a clue for you. I am going to start the scene. So, Michael, why don't you go ahead and give me the action?
And action.
Mr. Larrabee.
Yes, Mish.
What did you say is in these boxes with the red lines on them?
That's blasting gelatin, Miss.
Isn't it dangerous?
Bless you, no, Miss. That's safety stuff. That is. That's my cockney there. That is. It can get wet and not do them any harm. If you set fire to it, it just burns. You can hit it with a hammer and it won't go off. At least, I don't think it will. It takes a detonator to set it off. I'll put it over to the side if it worries you, though.
No, we may need it.
And
mercifully,
it may have been the first Massacre Theater that was longer than the film. We are massacring.
Long. We did certainly torpedo a well-respected film there. If you think you know which movie that was from, email the title along with your name and your location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, April 7.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
A few quick notes here before we do get to our list of top five movie boats. Adam is prepping his return. It's in the near future, though I understand we're going to be lucky enough to have you back for next week's show.
Yes.
Reviewing Nymphomaniac.
Yes. And luck had nothing to do with it. Oh, honestly.
In that time, we should probably put the furniture back the way it was. So we've got a little time to do that.
That's right.
Adam's not just sitting still, though. He's looking to do, I know he's reaching out and trying to put this together, interviews with director David Gordon Green and one of the young stars of Joe, his next film, Ty Sheridan. So hopefully that will come together. And he's also hoping to interview director Jonathan Glazer, whose new film is Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson. Also did want to mention that we're going to try to get a little bonus content in this week. Probably going to feature listener feedback on Harold Ramis. That was a show we did a few weeks ago, Michael, to honor his career. And then we also covered Wes Anderson with The Grand Budapest Hotel. Some listeners did write in about their favorite Anderson scenes and films. So we'll get to that in bonus content. You can find information about accessing that content at filmspotting.net. That's where you can find out how to get the Film Spotting app, which is available on iPhone or Android or Windows 8 phones. Those apps are the best way to get the bonus content. So just go to filmspotting.net and click on the apps link.
Mark plus 8 seconds, plus 9, plus 10 seconds, plus 11, plus 12, plus 13 seconds, plus 14, plus 15 seconds, Captain, if we're out of position by so much as a boat length.
Torpedo impact now 15 seconds.
Sound collision.
Sound collision.
Captain, we're out of the way.
You're relieved.
Foraging.
That was Sean Connery's Marco Ramius in a scene from 1990's The Hunt for Red October, directed by John McTiernan. I don't know, a good action movie, great action movie, where would you put it,
yeah,
Michael?
Good.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good, okay.
But good.
Either way, it's not eligible for this week's Film Spotting Top 5 movie Boats, which was inspired by our review earlier of Darren Aronofsky's Noah and his famous biblical vessel. There are people who will tell you that a submarine is a boat. I've been told that myself in trying to compile this list the last week or so, and they might be right, but we're going to save movie subs for another list. You know, after nearly 500 shows, you've got to be thinking ahead and kind of dice these things up as much as you can.
It's time to do some estate planning.
Exactly. So what does that leave us with if we're setting subs aside, Michael? Did you put any other additional criteria on your list?
It's not so much the design, the beauty, the seaworthiness of whatever the vessels you're dealing with in the movie are. It's just more that, you know, do you love the film?
Okay.
And is it does some sort of ship, some sort of boat, some sort of ocean going something or other, or river going something or other, does it fit in prominently enough to justify it? That's it.
Got it.
You got to go for that, because it's a great stage for all kinds of human drama, any kind of boat. So that's how I looked at it.
All right. Well, let's see if you can justify your number five.
Okay, it's about a ship called the Titanic. I don't know if you've heard about this, but
I have.
It's been on screen several times, and this is kind of a two or three way pick, which I know Adam hates, and you know I'll never be asked back. But back in the 40s, Nazi Germany produced a film about the Titanic that is a striking bit of propaganda, anti-capitalist, anti-Western propaganda. It's worth seeing just because some sequences, second unit stuff essentially, was used from that film in the British picture from 1958, A Night to Remember, which is a lot of people's certainly favorite Titanic film, and that it's a more, for the time, it was a more semi-documentary approach. And then of course, that's all forgotten once James Cameron comes along with this insanely over-budgeted folly that everybody thought was going to be a huge financial disaster, Titanic from the 90s. And of course, it's the biggest movie of all time, at least for a while. And why is it, Josh, we keep coming back to that particular shipwreck? Is it just because it has all this sort of juicy, reductive class warfare going on in it? Is it because there's just something sort of horrifying and sort of sickly beautiful about the sight of that thing going down out you know, up against the ice? I don't know, but I think if you look at all three of those films, and you really should if you haven't seen either A Night to Remember or the German picture, it's worth seeing just to kind of see why, ask yourself why that remains the 20th century disaster, really above all else, that kind of gets at this humankind's machine age folly, this idea that we can make something unsinkable. I'm not saying anything that people haven't speculated on a million times, but I always say about the Titanic that people know the best, Josh, that it's the worst written film I've ever happily seen twice. Because it is.
It makes sense.
It's the worst. It's the worst script ever.
You're not
written.
Going for the script. This is true.
Well, no, and of course you are, because the movie has to. The one thing Cameron did figure out with Titanic, whether you hate it or not, is that he figured out somehow to kind of structure that story to get a huge global popular audience to kind of happily float along with all the cliched nonsense for 3 hours. And I think the secret ingredient, not so secret ingredient with that picture, really is more than DiCaprio. I think Kate Winslet, the fact that she's just a young and tremendously good actress, and just when you are ready to about to give up on the suffering and the, you know, the grueling aspects of what happens after the worst has happened, Winslet floating sort of on that piece of wood out among the ice floes and all the dead bodies is really kind of remarkable melodramatic acting, and the film is shamelessly effective as a movie. So there you go. That's my number five. The letters can start coming in.
Well, it is a melodrama, and so that maybe that's why it resonates with people over time. It's a tried and true formula that they did manage to, I would agree, make work well enough. So you're opening up here with three films. Your
three.
Number five, three films.
Three,
okay.
Yeah.
I mean, Adam will probably, he'd probably be okay. He doesn't mind when he does it. I don't think he likes it when I do it. We'll find out how he feels when you do it. So.
All right, good.
Well, I am going to get a film out of the way
off the top without putting it on my list by naming this the Belafonte Memorial List from The Life Aquatic. Bill Murray's boat there clearly would have been on my list, but having just talked so much about that film, did spend a lot of time. I know it's not your favorite Wes Anderson film. But,
recently. We talked about it recently.
We talked about it recently, so I thought I would set that aside. It's the Belafonte Memorial List. I focused a little bit more on the boats, I think, than you did, it sounds like. Not necessarily the movies, just to kind of help me pare my list down a little bit. What that left me with at number five was The Stonewall Jackson from Buster Keaton's Steamboat Bill Jr. This is his 1928 silent comedy in which he plays this well-manicured, northern-bred son who visits his gruff southern steamboat captain father in order to take over the family business. This is probably more famous for its windstorm sequence, I would guess, in which Keaton ambles among buildings as their facades fly all around, and that does take place on shore. But the film also uses the Stonewall Jackson, which is the father's steamboat, for a lot of the set pieces. Early on, there's a throwaway gag about the decrepit boat, which ends up later in the film being condemned, actually. There's this great gag where one of the life preservers is tossed into the water and just sinks right away like a stone. I like that touch. The movie also gets a lot of mileage out of Keaton trying to negotiate a plank that connects the Stonewall Jackson to the fancy new steamship that's docked ahead of it. And this modern steamship, it represents the wave of the future. And the movie has, you know, this idea of progress and what's lost in the process. It's one of the things, one of the underlying things the movie is playing with here. So in keeping with that, the boat of the title is this sadly comic symbol of times gone by.
Yeah, that's a great pick. And that I hadn't realized that that film came out the same year as the Broadway musical landmark Showboat, based on the Edna Ferber novel, came out. So already it was in the air that you're kind of looking back at the previous 50 years or so of American history and American popular entertainment. And it was already kind of, as you say, a symbol of days gone by, and also kind of a real Southern emblem that was kind of a loaded image in many ways the further along the 20th century you got. But Keaton, what do you want? He's one of the great film artists of any time. But we really needed to have a nautical expert on this show, Josh, because I'm about to murder all the technical descriptions of this, because I don't know a paddle.
We may not be using the right terms.
Yes, paddle boat, steamboat, whatever. But it's as recently as 12 Years a Slave last year, we had that striking recurring that visual motif of the paddle wheel shot from the inside. As sort of this image of, you know, the dark side of history just sort of grinding along. There's also, in a different context entirely, like the Keaton film, there's a whole kind of fragrant romance to the image of it, and it's an evocation of another era, and it's in Keaton's hands. It's beautiful.
All right, what do you have at number four?
It's another Keaton film.
Oh,
it's
nice.
It's The Navigator from 1924, which is one of Keaton's biggest hits in the silent era in the 20s, and he plays a wealthy man who sort of on a impulsive whim decides to propose to his neighbor across the street, and he has a servant book passage for a honeymoon sea cruise to Honolulu, but he's rejected, and he decides to take the trip anyway, and for various reasons that we won't go into here, the intended bride and Keaton's character end up on the same vessel, the Navigator, anyway. And there's two countries at war. There's spies skulking around. And the strange thing about this film, Josh, and I hadn't seen it for a long time, is that it's kind of got this charming, faraway Neverland quality, because it's two people who have this whole boat to themselves, and they're just it's kind of a great playground for Keaton's particularly forlorn aura. You know, he's not really a man of the crowds. You know, he is out out there with his mate, out there all alone, and just sort of trying to make do, and the sight gags are fantastically clever. There's nothing really as famous or as indelible as the cyclone sequence or the waterfall rescue sequence in Our Hospitality, all that sort of thing. But it's a beautiful film, and it's best known for that great image of Keaton sort of sticking his body way, way out over the mast, looking through the telescope. And I don't know. To me, when I see Keaton in still photographs or in motion in a movie like The Navigator, I'm seeing a kind of visual poetry that will never die. And if you haven't seen The Navigator, it's 59 minutes of real artistry.
Well, I'd say we have Keaton covered, perhaps even the silent era, though. I don't know. That might come back. We'll have to see.
Let's move on to Laurel and Hardy's Saps at Sea, 1940.
I'm
going to
jump ahead for my number four a little bit further than that, 1944. Okay. And that's for Lifeboat, the mid-career experiment from Alfred Hitchcock. Probably not upper echelon Hitchcock, I would say, but I think it's still a significant film. It is set entirely on the lifeboat of the title after this German U-boat torpedoes an Allied ship, and a handful of the survivors make it to this rescue craft. One of them is actually the German U-boat captain. It too was sunk. And this, of course, ups the moral dilemma ante for the movie. In terms of how the lifeboat itself is used in the film, it's striking to me how Hitchcock repeatedly emphasizes how low the boat is in the water. And we get the sense of how near that threat is to all of the characters. There's a key shot for me in this film. It's really a merciless Hitchcock one. And it comes after one of the survivors has committed suicide in the night by silently slipping overboard. We don't see that. Instead, like the others in the boat, we discover this in the morning, and Hitchcock delivers the blow with this insert shot of a taut rope that leads from the boat down into the water, and we assume underneath is the victim's body. Now, the movie isn't this grim throughout. Tallulah Bankhead plays a society journalist, and she really anchors the film with a dry wit. She almost is acting like she's hosting a dinner party on this boat rather than in some dire situation. I mean, she's not light completely throughout, but overall, that's the impression she does give. So this is entertaining as well. But even in those lighter moments, the use of the boat never lets us forget that the water is only a few feet away.
What part of the ship are you from, darling?
Engine room. I was off duty in the washroom, thanks. Caught with my... I was washing my hands when the torpedo smacked us. Most of the crew were trapped like rats. When I got to topside, it was a shambles.
Quite an item. Reminded me of an air raid once that hit me in Chungking.
Reminded me of a slaughterhouse I once worked at in Chicago. Those Nazi buzzards of tin fish ain't enough. They've got to shell us, too.
Yeah, it's a good pick. Hitchcock loved these kind of crazy technical challenges. 4 years later, he made Rope, which was a series of 10-minute takes, all seemingly done as one continuous take. And Lifeboat is, I'd say you're right, it's kind of the top of the second echelon for Hitchcock. And it really is just one of the few wartime propaganda-minded films designed to kind of, at least indirectly, rally the home front and rally the troops and point out that you can't trust a Nazi. But it's got kind of an effective compression. It's like Grand Hotel, all these disparate characters, but it's the tiniest floating hotel you can imagine.
Right.
And I remember it's a particularly good one to show kids, I think, because I remember as a 10 or 11-year-old really being kind of absorbed by this one, especially just when I was getting into Hitchcock. And Hitchcock, I think, is always the first director you should try to get any kid, whatever their taste, interested in, because you can show them four or five different things, especially from those early middle career years, and just find a way to really grab him, because he's such the technical stunt at the center of Lifeboat is kind of outrageous, and it's also completely right.
Maybe not start with Psycho with the kids, though, right?
No,
ease them into that a little bit
ease
later.
Ease them into that and avoid Frenzy entirely. Yeah.
Well, you're right about Lifeboat being a propaganda film, which I didn't think about at all going into it, and I was surprised how much of that is played up in terms of this German character and the other sentiments. It's a moral dilemma too, but yeah, you definitely get the underlying gist there of what we're supposed to take away about the Nazis and really the Germans, in a lot of ways.
It's a moral dilemma until he just needs to be killed. But that's about as much of a, it was hard even for a first-rate director to get much more complicated nuances into that kind of film, studio film made during World War II. We promise there really won't be any more references to Titanic, any of the versions of Titanic, even though we have a few picks left. Josh and I will finish off our lists of the top five movie boats in a moment. Stay with us.
The man appeared to me inside that yellow wood. I caught his name in the dirt in a crossroads where we stood. Said, are you looking for directions? I said, gee, I wish you would. Oh, which way? Follow the distant light. Yeah. And although you're never near it,
donation time here on Film Spotting, where we get a chance to say thank you to all of those who have contributed some of their hard-earned money to keep us going. We want to start with an email from a donor we received asking us for a favor, and it's one we wanted to honor. This comes from Rob, who's from Perth, Australia, a $5 a month subscriber.
He writes, about 2 years ago, while sitting on a bus in the Irrawaddy Delta of Myanmar, I was trying out several film podcasts in an attempt to find the one. While experiencing mostly disappointing, angry film rants, I eventually stumbled. See, I like to bring the angry film rants to this.
But, we've noticed.
Yeah. I eventually stumbled across Film Spotting, and I've had a reliable and enjoyable podcast friend ever since. As I sat on those windy roads surrounded by overflowing vomit bags, it was a very windy road, I relaxed to the best films of 2011 discussion, and I've been a regular listener since, almost exactly as long as Josh has been a co-host.
Rob continues, I'm writing to ask if you could do me a favor and give a literacy project I'm a part of a shout-out on Film Spotting. We deliver books, train teachers, employ local literacy officers, and hold book parties in an attempt to encourage literacy development in rural Laos. Our book parties use games, songs, dances, and most importantly, storytelling to engage children and develop their literacy skills in what we hope leads to a sustainable and community-driven development project. As an amateur filmmaker myself, I have created 9 videos telling the story of our project and of the wider story of literacy in Laos. They will be released slowly over the next 6 weeks, but you can find them on our YouTube channel. Any support you can give me would be greatly appreciated. Keep up the good work. I don't know what I would do without you. Well, Rob, we certainly think that is an admirable initiative you are a part of, so we will provide a link for listeners to check out what you're up to in the show notes. One quick note here about the music on this week's show. It's from Pennsylvania's Dr. Dog, comes from their 2013 album B Room. You heard the songs The Truth and Distant Light. Dr. Dog gets back on the road in June. They're going to have dates in Tulsa, Missouri, and Indianapolis. All right, we do move on to give a few thank yous here to recent donors, one of whom is a platinum-level donor.
What about Bob? Bob of Worcester, Mass.
We also have $5 a month donor.
And that's from Suzanne of Mountain View, California.
And we received this note, Michael, largely because of you. It comes from Nathaniel in Olathe, Kansas. He says, this isn't much, but it's expressly because Michael Phillips asked, as you did on the last show.
Nice. I begged.
If a little bit can help him be on the show more often and make you all a consistent trio, I'm happy to help. You did, Michael, on the last show, ask if you could be individually sponsored as a supporting co-host. And Nathaniel stepped up to the plate. Is there anything else you want to ask for since you have this power?
It's not as a supporting. It's more as a supreme sort of, you know, trust fund level sort of supported guest.
Now you want a title too, huh? Thank you to all our monthly donors and our listeners. We do appreciate all the support you do give to the show. Finally, quick note here. We want to plug the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. He does interviews with screenwriters on his podcast, which is available in iTunes. And a recent project he's been involved with as well is his Backstory magazine app. That's available for the iPad. To find out more information about how you can get that, visit backstory.net. Give me the distant light. Oh, oh no, I cannot do it. Give me the distant light.
Hi there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. Allison Wilmore here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And on the new episode of SVU, Matt Singer and I barricade ourselves in the studio as we review David Fincher's Panic Room.
In honor of Panic Room, we'll also recommend some other claustrophobic movies you can rent or stream at home right now. Also, is it my imagination or is the room, is it getting smaller? I don't know. I'm going to go get some air. But in the meantime, to listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Isn't your son feeling well?
What's the matter with you?
Well, I mean to say, haven't we met?
But of course we have. Your father just introduced us.
Aren't you feeling well?
Sure.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You meant, hadn't you met me before someplace?
Yeah.
Oh, very probably. Let me see, where could it have been? Deauville.
No.
Biarritz?
No.
I know, Le Touquet. You had a mustache at the time and you tried to beat me at a dance in the casino.
No.
Huh? I give up.
Well, let's have a drink.
It couldn't have been on the SS Southern Queen between here and South America, could it?
Oh, I'm afraid not. You see, I've never been in South America.
You've never been in South America?
She's never been in South America.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. We return to this week's top 5 movie boats with that scene from Preston Sturges' The Lady Eve. Barbara Stanwyck's Jean there is in her Lady Eve guise with Henry Fonda's befuddled beer heir, Charles Pike. Michael, why did Sturge's classic screwball romance make your top five movie boats list at number three?
Josh, if this thing hadn't been set on a ship, I still would have picked it because I love the movie.
Wow.
And that's how much I care about your damn kid.
Taking this so seriously, Michael.
The first half of The Lady Eve does take place on kind of a swank ocean liner, and you have this Nevish professor played by Henry Fonda, who's a snake expert who's been up the Amazon, as he keeps saying, for a year now, and is a little bit he's more love starved than he realized. He runs into this sleek, really, really sharp card sharp played by Barbara Stanwyck, and there are scenes in this picture, Josh, that are among the best and funniest and most romantic and the sexiest that Preston Sturges ever wrote for, especially for women, and nobody wrote better comic female roles than Sturges. And it's the only time, honestly, for decades after the pre-code era was over, it was hard to find any studio film that really developed three-dimensionally interesting female leads, especially in a comedy, without kind of ultimately patronizing the characters or confining them to these really strict societal roles. Sturges would have none of that. I just love the kind of the mixture of satire, and in fact, this movie is about as biblical as Noah in terms of the biblical references with snakes and Eve and the apple and temptation and all the rest of it. But the scenes set on board the ocean liner just kind of take you back to it's just 20th century farce's classic location. And there's a line in the film where, among other things, Gene, played by Stanwyck, says, I need this guy like the axe needs the turkey, which I love. But there's also a line where she's declaring her love for him, and the ruses and the pretenses are falling. And she says, they say a moonlit deck is a woman's business office. Now, that's a somewhat antiquated line, but it also kind of gets at the when you hear Stanwyck deliver it, you believe every syllable of it. And if people haven't seen The Lady Eve for a while, they just need to see it, boat or no. And it's, as I say, the first half of this picture is kind of indebted to that ocean liner setting. But so many great films of the studio era, the golden studio era, really kept going back to ocean liners because they were playgrounds and kind of universes unto themselves.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. They're isolated in a way that the filmmakers can use. Well, okay, you've made your case for The Lady Eve as a top five boat movie.
It's a boat movie.
Top five movie boat movie.
Right.
Okay. We'll see if the listeners agree with that. I'll accept it for now. Before we get to my number three, just a quick recap here of our earlier picks. I had Steamboat Bill Jr. and Lifeboat. You mentioned another Buster Keaton film, The Navigator, as well as a three-pack there with Titanic from James Cameron.
Yep.
The 1943 German film Titanic and A Night to Remember.
Right.
Okay. Put those all together. And you just talked about The Lady Eve, so that brings us to my number three movie boat, which is The Saracen from Dead Calm. This is a 1989 thriller. It was Nicole Kidman's breakout film. And the Saracen is this private yacht on which Kidman, as this distraught wife, and Sam Neill, as her naval officer husband, have retreated after suffering a recent tragedy. The husband intends it as therapy, but due to a handful of bad decisions on his part, it becomes another trial, especially after they pick up Billy Zane as the supposed lone survivor of a schooner that's adrift at sea. This works really well as a feminist thriller, thanks especially to Kidman. She grows from helpless, grief-stricken woman to empowered heroine, but she never panders to character in either direction, because she could have gone strongly one way at the beginning and then another way at the end, but instead she's somehow true to the character while making this journey. Dead Calm was also a breakthrough for the Australian director, Philip Noyce, and he made an interesting decision in terms of using the space of this yacht. Instead of emphasizing the claustrophobia, he turns it into something of a hamster maze so that his camera races in and out of portholes and corridors. And once the action really gets going, that's key. Another thing he does is that he shoots the boat, for the most part, on this eerily placid sea. And rather than a sense of peace, which you think it would give, or tranquility, which I think is what the husband was probably going for, by having this mirrored surface all the time, things have a latently sinister quality.
Hmm.
So Dead Calm, that's my number three.
Do you think Nicole Kidman had the stuff right away at this point in her career early on?
I think she did. I think at this point in her career, she did, for sure. I mean, I was really surprised at how strong of a performance this was when I went back to take a look at Dead Calm. But I think
she had done a number of things before this in Australia, so I'm not sure, you know, I can't really speak to whether it was an instantaneous gift she had, but man, you do see it here. All right, how about your number two, Michael?
My number two is a film that I don't think it's a classic necessarily, Josh, but it's just in terms of the ship, the craft itself, I have to vote for the HMS Surprise of Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. And this is Peter Weir's film version of the Patrick O'Brien novel. I know about as much of nautical matters as I do about biblical matters, Josh, but I think this film is a film that gets better every year. The fact that it's Russell Crowe again, proving that he knows exactly what to do when he's anchoring a period epic that requires kind of a stalwart presence of some gravitas, but doesn't need the kind of harumphing Charlton Heston quality. I think the ship is just, it's beautifully rendered. Weir is a filmmaker that didn't and doesn't necessarily get all hung up in finding the most technologically up-to-date ways to recreate a sliver of the past and a big seagoing emblem of the past. It's just really has got amazing texture. I love the sequences in the Galapagos where the film really just sort of takes a breather, and you have scenes like Paul Bettany's Charles Darwin-like naturalist who's along for the voyage, just sort of sketching away in this strange land with these fantastic creatures. The whole movie really does feel like a piece of the past, not just a then-contemporary film about the past. And beautiful ship. And it takes you back to Errol Flynn on the Seahawk, mm-hmm. and you know, films from the Hollywood's golden age, but for a different historical purpose. I like the film a great deal.
Captain Howard and the Marines will sweep their weather deck with swivel gun and musket fire from the tops. They'll try and even the odds for us before we board. They mean to take us as a prize. And we are worth more to them undamaged. Their greed will be their downfall. England is under threat of invasion. And though we be on the far side of the world, this ship is our home. This ship is England.
Yeah, I did like it too. And what I remember about it is that attention to detail, to historical detail. I wouldn't know either what they got right and what they got wrong, but they certainly immersed you in the reality of that time. And this attention to detail, a lot of it is on that ship.
Mm-hmm.
My number two is one of the foundational films, Sergei Eisenstein's 1925 battleship Potemkin. This is a silent exercise in Soviet propaganda. It's a dramatization of the Potemkin uprising in which mutinous sailors rebelled against the Tsarist regime. The ship itself, it's this hulking steel behemoth, and it's the nexus for the revolt, really, which does eventually spread from the sailors to the people on the shore. Probably the movie's most famous section is the Odessa step sequence, where civilians are gunned down by Tsarist troops. Before this, though, is the mutiny on the battleship. One memorable moment for me comes when the captain first gets rumblings of this, and he threatens to hang any traitors from the ship's yardarm. Suddenly, in one of the instances of the Soviet use of montage, there's this quick cut to the ghostly images of men hanging there, almost this subliminal-like thing that we get. Now, once the sailors do take over, the Potemkin becomes a symbol for the wave of change that's going to sweep through the country. And that's something Roger Ebert did note in his great movies review. He said, "News of the uprising reaches the Russian fleet, which speeds toward Odessa to put it down. The Potemkin and a destroyer, also commanded by revolutionaries, steam out to meet them. Eisenstein creates tension by cutting between the approach fleet, the brave Potemkin, and details of the onboard preparation. At the last moment, the men of the Potemkin signal their comrades in the fleet to join them, and the Potemkin steams among the oncoming ships without a shot being fired at it." This is one of the first films you see if you're at all interested in really studying the movies, whether that comes in high school or college, whatever. And it's still one of the greats, and with an instrumental boat, just had to be on my list.
I saw that film with the Minnesota Orchestra playing a score.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was just, you know, 65-piece orchestra, I believe, and it's got an irresistible power, and like all propaganda films, and it's one of the very highest examples of that. It's just you kind of realize its effect later, because the effect is so strong at the time you don't even sort of have anything beyond your immediate gut emotional response to it, which is overwhelming. And it's a great. I still remember seeing that film for the first time in high school film class, and those maggots on the meat.
Yes, the maggots.
And I was ready to. I was muttering under my breath, "Strike!
You are all on board, huh?" All right, Michael. That does bring us to our number one picks for the best movie boats of all time. Who have you got in that slot, Michael?
All right. It's the opposite of Potemkin's hard driving montage. And all that. It's Jean Vigo's poetic realism. The film is from 1934. It's L'Atelante.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of just a crushingly, painfully small handful of films by this great artist, Jean Vigo, who died before he turned 30 of tuberculosis. And this is a wonderful, wonderful kind of bittersweet love story. It begins with a captain of a barge, the L'Atelante of the title, who's married this woman, Parlo, and he's taking her on a honeymoon. Unfortunately, he hasn't gotten rid of the ship's first mate, the Camba boy as well. So the newlyweds are in very tight quarters with these other two guys. And very little happens in terms of narrative, Josh. The bride sort of runs away to see the sights of Paris on her own, and then there's a confrontation and an argument with the husband later. And this film, first time I saw it, I really honestly couldn't even understand why I was having such a strong reaction to it, because it doesn't work on any kind of strong narrative level. It's really much more about this sort of young and reckless and possibly ill-advised love match. But the sights and the smells and the whole feeling of this barge life, this odd, marginalized life on water, but in a very narrow set of canals in France, it feels like it's taking place centuries and centuries ago, but it's really just a few decades. And for folks who haven't discovered the film and don't know Vigo, they just need to see L'Atelante, and they need to see his previous film, which is a very strange length, just about 40 minutes, I think, called Zero for Conduct, which is still one of the great rebellious school kids sort of anthems ever. I'm in love with this film, and I haven't seen it for a long time, and I can't wait to see it again.
Well, another older film as well, which our picks have tended to be for the most part, for whatever reason. I don't know what that's about, but my number one is going to bring us a little bit more to the modern era. It's The Orca from Jaws.
Jaws.
It's, you know, Robert Shaw's shark hunting vessel and Steven Spielberg's classic thriller, and really where the climactic action section of the film does take place. And one of the key things that Spielberg does in this section is to immerse us in the mechanics of the ship. We get a little bit about the engine failure and what that means and how that works, but we especially get how this barrel and harpoon system works that they use to pierce the shark and then try to tire it out and slow it down with the barrels that are trailing behind.
Kill it, quick! Kill it! Now! Shoot! Time! See how long that barrel takes to bring him up.
Lean on the barrel! I'm coming around again!
Spielberg also uses the boat as a suspense set and talked about how these ocean liners are attractive to filmmakers for their isolation. And we get a different version of that with Spielberg here, because the boat is so small. Mm. It becomes this tight place for suspense. The moment when Jaws thuds against the hull, that's a lot scarier than having a serial killer knock at your front door. At least it was for me. We also get some insert shots here that are as merciless as Hitchcock's. The one that I always love each time it catches me when I watch this movie again is when two of them, it's probably Scheider and Dreyfus, are sort of hanging on the edge of the boat and trying to shuffle away to the front. And one of them slips. Their foot goes off just for a quick second. And you think, they're going in. They're going in.
There's another great moment in that film. I mean, I love that film. It's probably my favorite Spielberg film still. And you can take the heartwarming ones. This is the heartless one. But even that's got heart. I love the timing of that sustained shot where Scheider's sheriff is chumming for bait, you know, throwing bait overboard. And he's just sort of talking to somebody, you know, off just over the cameraman's shoulder. And then you see the first really good close-up of Bruce the shark for about 2 seconds. And it comes on a beat that you do not expect. And I still remember the sound of that scream from the first time I saw that in high school. And then the reaction shot is fantastic. It's just Scheider kind of like, whoop, you know, like this amazing kind of mugging, almost a mugging reaction shot. And it was one of the biggest screams followed by one of the biggest laughs I ever heard in the theater.
And the key there, too, is we have to know the placement of where everyone is. And it goes again back to Hitchcock's Lifeboat, in knowing how close they are to the water and where the shark might be. Yeah,
right, right.
It works ingeniously. One of my visceral memories of watching this as a kid is how I despaired when the orca started breaking up and going down. I mean, I wanted to cling to that boat as tightly as Scheider and Dreyfus cling to the wreckage in the final scene. I just felt like all hope is lost if that thing goes.
Well, it's all very, it's very, very kind of lo-fi. You know, you're talking about a junky old boat that's barely seaworthy, but somehow
when they head out and then
at the start. But that's kind of what's wonderful about the film. It's got a very unglamorous setting there, and of course a lot of it takes place on land, like the beach sequence where Scheider sees the first attack, but Spielberg didn't know what he had. He really thought that the filming wasn't going well, the shark wasn't cooperating, and shooting on water is always devilishly difficult, and the whole thing just felt like it wasn't quite going to hang together. And then suddenly in the editing room, the shark works just well enough to get by, at least until the moment when he has to jump up and actually start chomping on Robert Shaw. That's the one bit that doesn't, you know what I mean? It's kind of a blunt moment.
It really is.
But man, that film works like gangbusters. I whenever that comes on, whether it's one of the shipboard sequences or not, I almost inevitably stay with it the whole rest of the way, because that film is just a magical combination of scares and laughs.
Well, the Orca was the first boat that came to mind, the first movie boat when I thought about this list, so it did have to be my number one pick. I'm sure there were some, though, Michael, that didn't quite make the cut for you. Do you have any honorable mentions you want to throw out there?
One film I really love a lot is called History is Made at Night. It's a film made in 1937, directed by Frank Borzage, and it deals with a love triangle between this shipping magnate, his wife, and a French head waiter, and it all takes place, most of it takes place on this great ocean liner, and it's got everything from a climax that essentially mimics the Titanic's fate, but it's all kind of done in this fairy tale romance, and Borzage's a real master of an intense kind of romanticism. He was great in the silent era, and he made some wonderful films in the sound era. I just recommend people see that film. History is Made at Night. Like The Lady Eve, Josh, it's not so much about the vessel itself, but it's the vessel as this place where everything can and anything can happen in terms of, you know, falling in love, the worst kind of seagoing tragedy. It's all possible in this setting. It's got three great performances from Colin Clive and Charles Boyer as the men, and Jean Arthur, one of my very favorite screen performers from the 30s and 40s, as the woman caught in between.
Well, my number six is Leviathan. I mean, the best movie of last year was a documentary that explored every nook and cranny of a commercial fishing boat, but I've talked about that plenty lately, so just an honorable mention here. For Adam's sake, I'm going to throw out there Werner Herzog's Fitzcarraldo, which Klaus Kinski tries to transport a steamship over a mountain.
Right.
Pretty sure that would have been on his list. I would have liked to have revisited Waterworld, just because there's some sick side of me that really wants to rewatch Waterworld, and I'm sure one of the crafts in that movie might have made this list. Also heard from a listener on Twitter, John Ganella. He suggested The Boat in the Tree from Mud. I'm not sure if that plays quite a big enough role to make a list, but I do like where his head is at there.
I like that.
Also, a couple of Errol Flynn films. You mentioned him in one of your picks. You could have gone with Captain Blood or The Seahawk. Some more older films there. And a film spotting confession I'll make. I have not seen either version, the Gable or the Brando version of Mutiny on the Bounty, so I'm not sure if they might have made the cut for me.
For sheer acrobatics, Josh, I think I'd have to put in The Crimson Pirate, which is a much more comic version of the sort of the sea-going adventures. And this is Burt Lancaster in 1952. Wonderful physical stunts, very little Hollywood optical effects interference in what an actor like, and a physical genius like Lancaster could do in that kind of role. And nobody brought more brio to that sort of open-air adventure than Lancaster. So.
Well, I'm sure there are other titles that we're not thinking of and that listeners have in mind, so please do send in your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744 or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting. A few films here we want to mention that are getting a limited release in Chicago this weekend. The first is Afternoon of the Fawn, Tanaquil Leclerc. It's a doc about Leclerc, the ballerina and muse for George Balanchine and Jerome Robbins, who was struck with polio and paralyzed at 27. Another film opening a limited release is Breathe In. Director Drake Doremus reteams with his Like Crazy star, Felicity Jones, for this. It's about a foreign exchange student's relationship with her host family. Guy Pearce and Amy Ryan are also in the cast. Jodorowsky's Dune is another limited release opening, which I understand you've seen, Michael.
Yeah, it's really good.
Is it?
It's about the film version of Dune that never was. that Alejandro Jodorowsky, who's this crazy cult filmmaker from Chile who made El Topo and basically helped invent the midnight movie circuit back in the early 70s, it's all about the film that for years he struggled to get the financing for, just to do this crackpot version of Dune based on a book that he acknowledges in the documentary he never even read before proposing that he would be the perfect director to do it. But it's a wonderful documentary about a film that that in an alternate universe we'd actually get a look at, but like so many pictures that never quite got the green light, you just have to wonder, what if?
He follows the Adam Kempinar school. Don't read the book for the movie review, so hey, don't read the book to make the movie version.
There you go.
That makes sense.
Don't you be dissing Adam on that. You know?
We have some films in wide release this weekend as well worth mentioning. Cesar Chavez is from actor-turned-director Diego Luna, starred in Y Tu Mama Tambien and Milk. This is a biopic about the civil rights activist and labor organizer Michael Peña does play Chavez. A Haunted House apparently earned a sequel. A Haunted House 2 is opening, the horror comedy with Marlon Wayans. And then Sabotage. This is from End of Watch director David Ayer. He's teaming up with Arnold Schwarzenegger for a thriller about an elite DEA task force. And the big boat of the week, of course, is Darren Aronofsky's Noah. Next week, Michael, you will be back. We are going to be reviewing both parts of Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac. I'm not sure if we'll be breaking this up and reviewing volume one only, not allowed to talk about volume two, or we want to just throw it all together.
All together.
We'll figure something out.
It's all on VOD at this point.
It is. So listeners,
let's deal with the whole thing.
And this way listeners can catch up with it and share their thoughts too. We'd love to hear those in advance. We'd also love to hear top five suggestions for this show, because we're not quite sure where we're going to go. The first place you think of is something involving sex, obviously, so let your imaginations run wild, listeners, perhaps, though I don't know if I'll want to read those emails. We'll see.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go, thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everybody at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.